I'd like to talk tonight about the myth of letting go. In looking over this talk tonight, a potential subtitle emerged. It's called Cracking the Code. See if you can see where the code might be. And maybe a little bit more important than that, where the cracking of the code might be. In all the world's religious and spiritual traditions, and thank goodness there's a lot of them, because there's a lot of different folks who need different messages. There is the Dharma. Dharma is a Sanskrit word. The Pali word for Dharma is Dhamma. But there isn't just a Buddhist Dharma or a Buddha Dharma. There's Christian Dharma, Sufi Dharma, Islamic Dharma, Judaic Dharma, your Dharma, my Dharma. There's lots of Dharma. Because there's lots of us. Dharma is a kind of a big word. And at least in Buddha Dharma, it means different things. It's the teachings themselves, the actual teachings, the written teachings, the oral teachings. So part of that Dharma is the methods, practices of meditation. The Dharma is also the laws of life, the laws of the universe. If you want, call them the laws of the cosmos. This is also the Dharma. Dharma is the truth of the way things really are. And my favorite, personal favorite part of that, is that Dharma also means freedom. Now, it's also true that in all the world's religious and spiritual traditions, in all the diversity, there's basically two, you might say, distinct categories. And one category are teachings, practices, methods that could be called progressive path. Progressive path Dharma, progressive path teachings. These teachings, progressive path teachings, regardless of tradition, are for the mind. Because the mind, in this case conceptual mind, is a mind of thought. It's a mind that's involved in time. It's a mind that thinks. So progressive path teachings are for that mind. They help that mind, when they work, make sense of itself. Much of the teachings that many human beings receive initially, sometimes as children, from parents and churches and organized religion, are progressive path teachings. In Vipassana meditation, which is part of Theravada Buddhism, just one branch or style of Buddhism, in Vipassana meditation, insight meditation, there's many different teachings that address this progressive path, or this nature of understanding that appears to emerge progressively. Now, the reason why these teachings are valuable is because if you believe that your mind needs help, if you believe or feel that your body mind needs help, needs assistance, needs something, and these teachings come to you, and they speak to you, they resonate with you, you begin to align to them. They may tell you what to do and not do. They may tell you how you should or could try to be or not be. They may tell you that there's a place that's better than where you are. They may tell you how you could potentially get there. Some of this making sense. Okay? Progressive path, it's for the mind. It's fine. It's wonderful that it's here. However, hidden inside progressive path teachings, progressive path dharma, is the nature of what we could call suddenness or instantaneousness or immediacy. And this immediacy or instantaneousness or suddenness describes the other categorization, or you could call it set of teachings that exist on planet Earth, in most, if not all, of the world's religious and spiritual traditions. For example, there's Sufi teachings, which is considered the mystical school of Islam, that are progressive path and instantaneous, both. And sometimes they seem to actually overlap. I'm going to give some examples. Just as in Buddha Dharma, yeah, or Dharma of Buddha, the progressive path teachings and the instantaneous path. Now notice this, instantaneous. What's an instantaneous path? If all there is suddenness, instantaneousness, immediacy, where's the path to that? Now, it's very interesting to notice what you're drawn to. What we often don't realize is that what we're drawn to is exactly what we need, even though it might not look that way. Sometimes at the beginning, sometimes in the middle, and sometimes at the end. We still don't see that what we're drawn to is perhaps, let me go with that word, exactly what we need. You know the saying, when the student's ready, the teachings appear. Progressive path instruction would give you different kinds of indicators, different kinds of suggestions, even commands on how to get ready. It runs the gamut. It can be just tiny little whispers that can hardly be recognized that suggests to you, hypnotic suggestions to you about what to do to get ready. So these two, you could say, categorizations sometimes debate with one another, have discussion, even argument, and even war. Because I hope it's clear that the fundamental driver for war on planet Earth is beliefs about the truth. So you can imagine or feel how important these matters are to people. We're not going to go back to the Middle Ages or the Inquisition. But if you read history and you believe what the books say, even just a little, it's pretty striking, startling, and maybe troubling. Sometimes a person is drawn to progressive path teachings because they make sense, they work, you see, because if something isn't working for me, then I'm probably not going to stick with it. Although sometimes human beings stick with things that aren't working quite a long time. They even really feel, they intuit, they would say, maybe in their quieter moments, I know this isn't working for me, but I'm going to hang in there. I'm going to hang in there. I'm going to tough it out. But I know it's not working. Or at least I think it's not working. I don't know. Maybe I'm confused. I'm not sure. Doubt might be there. But you know how tough we can get, right? Sometimes just for leisure, I mountain bike. And I ride with gentlemen who are much too young for me to be riding with, and they're much too fast for me often to be riding with as well. The other day, my friend was riding in front of me and he ran over an armadillo. Now the armadillo ran in front of him. And the armadillo rolled around underneath his tires, front tire, back tire, popped up, did kind of a half-twist spin, landed on his back, and ran away. And I stopped because it ran like, you know how they go. Sometimes they just go like this, and then they pause, and then they go like this, and then they pause, and they go like this. So he does a little this, actually this way, this. He pauses, and I'm thinking, he just got smashed. And I pause, and my friend keeps going. I pause. See, because my friend is blaming him. Stupid armadillo, he got in my way. He's paused, and I go towards him, and he senses me, I'm assuming, and he takes off again. Resilient. He got clobbered. Spun around, run over twice, and seemed to move fine afterwards. We are pretty tough characters, but we're also incredibly vulnerable at the same time. We have this incredible mix of durability and vulnerability. When I say vulnerability, I don't just mean fragility. That's one kind of vulnerability. Vulnerability in our capacity for openness. Progressive path teachings appear at times for some humans to prepare them to receive the instantaneous nature of their true nature. They seem to like bring you on an elevator, bring you up to the floor where the instantaneous teachings can actually be received. But you're not really going up. It's just an image. You might think you're going up. I'm going up. I'm progressing upwards. You see, because a lot of those progressive path teachings, watch this, they say the place to go is up. Heaven is up. The better, higher realms are up. Your kundalini's up. It's up, 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 baby. It's not level, and it's certainly not down. It's got to go up. The instantaneous nature of our original nature is not up, down, or even level. It has nothing to do with those measurements. Let me give an example of an instantaneous, Steve used the word this afternoon for those who were here for the stretching, pith. That means direct, immediate, pointing out, pithy teaching. And may I gain favor with St. Francis now as I utter these words. It's okay to pray for yourself. From the Gospel of Thomas, a gospel that didn't get as much attention historically and even today as perhaps it deserves. In the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus of Nazareth apparently said the following: recognize what is in your sight, and what is hidden will become clear to you. Now, if that is not Vipassana meditation, if that is not a pithy dharmic instruction, I don't know what is. What you begin to recognize seems slowly but surely, because you wouldn't be here if you weren't interested in recognizing these matters. You'd be doing something else on Friday night. Is that what it is? Friday, yeah, okay. Truth has an ambience, it has a resonance, it has a sense about it that crosses over, that even dissolves barriers, lines of differentiation, schools of thought, methods of practice. Truth has the power to cut through. And in a way says, you ready? Here. And so, one of the pitfalls in the instantaneous schools is that the pith instruction, the simple words, the pointing out is given, and it just stays conceptual, it just confuses, it doesn't make sense, it doesn't work. And the student may say, I'm not ready. I need something that works for me. I need something that connects. I need something that I can understand, because I don't understand what it means to hear the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. I don't understand what was meant by you must become like a child to enter the kingdom. Wait a minute. Maybe I do know something about that. I need to become humble. I need to become simple. I need to renounce some of my stuff, at least some, because I had less when I was a child. I need to loosen up my egoic identity. Maybe I need to read fairy tales. Maybe I need to read children's books. Maybe I need to get around children, because I don't know what it means to be like a child again. Never mind what it means to enter the kingdom. Okay, that's the warm-up for the talk. From the moment of separation, and most of us don't remember that moment, but it happened for most of us at some point, where we began to conceive, feel, sense ourselves as separate from things and other people. When that moment arises, and by the way, that's the moment where the I thought arose, I am, and then words filled in there. We don't remember this. Most humans don't. But if you ever perceive yourself, sense yourself, believe yourself or you might say know yourself, as something that seems separate from other things or other human beings, you bet that moment arose somewhere. It started. When that moment arises, there's a bifurcation that occurs. The initial response is bewilderment, because there's a moment of lostness, uncertainty, confusion. In some cases, that bewilderment and that confusion goes on for quite some time. Have you noticed how confusion can carry on? It's its own audience, or you're watching it, but it's got quite some life force to it, it seems. The other half of the bifurcation is seeking. Separation, bewilderment, seeking. Embedded inside the seeking tendency, that's all it is the idea of a seeker. Someone who's seeking inside the tendency of seeking. If you don't like the word seeking, you can call it wanting, you can call it desiring, you can call it longing, you can call it hoping. Any of these words could work for you. Regardless of your background around forms of conditioning about the truth, God, reality, true nature, original nature, or any of these things, for most, embedded in the conditioning code, there's a notion that something isn't right. Something's off, out of place, out of sorts, a little or a lot. And it's focalized, or you could say, originating within the sense of me. Now that gets projected outwards, and you can look into the world of relationships, societies, culture, the world itself. You can look at all these different, you could say, dimensions of experience and say there's something off, a little or a lot, in a lot of those places as well. And then, of course, there must arise in a caring human being responses to that, something to do about that. Conditioning says the discovery or alignment with truth, God, reality, or true nature will remedy this situation of disturbance, bewilderment, if I am really fortunate. And if I'm really fortunate, this remedy will happen once and for all. Bang. Job done. This conditioning that I'm speaking to in the form of ideas, conceptions, beliefs about truth, God, reality, true nature, are simply that. They're just conceptions. First thing that needs to be recognized, if you're in a sort of God-centered path, as contrasted to original nature-centered path, is the recognition that you have no idea what those things are, and that any concept you have about those things is simply that. So the first realization of God is the realization of the concepts of God. As those fall away, then something else can begin to come through. If those concepts are there, they fill up the space. And put truth in there, if you like, original nature in there, Buddha nature, any of these kinds of things, depending on your orientation. So we can see that the sense of something being off takes a lot of different shapes, from the body sense to the heart sense to the mind sense to the perceived world sense. And this view that something's off, out of balance, is embedded, deeply embedded in the idea of healing. the idea of healing, the notion of healing, cannot arise unless there's some notion that something's off or needs to be healed. And as life unfolds, the conditions of life, the conditioning of life, can seem to get better or worse. Sometimes it gets a lot better, it seems, in a sensory way, mental way, emotional way, and sometimes it seems to get really bad. Like a kind of long day mare, it's a nightmare during the day, that there doesn't seem to be an end to these experiences here, these feelings, these thoughts, this story in the head, this discomfort. It's carrying on. I don't know about impermanence, the mind might say. Worked everywhere else, but not here. So whether it gets better or worse, that means the conditions, let's call it the weather if you like, whether it gets better or worse, a lot better, a lot worse, as long as there's a belief that there's something to cultivate, improve upon, or change, as long as that belief is operating, then the condition is operating, and ultimately the struggle to exist better will go on. The struggle to exist better will go on. Little tiny bit of struggle, medium size, big struggle to exist better. Born directly from an identification with investment in the conditions that are ever changing like the weather. The release from struggle to exist better. There is a release. It's part of the third noble truth of the Buddha, the cessation of the struggle to exist better. It doesn't leave a human being incapable, uncaring, vegetable-like, just sitting there. It frees the responsiveness so that if you, so to speak, want to do something in relation to the life of others, the world situation, the environment, the ecology, the political, whatever, the energy is more free to do that, more free than ever before. Because there's an understanding that's present in those actions that's not invested in a fixated way upon the results. Without seeing the conditioning that drives the struggle to survive better, and how that struggle to survive better can be happening through the thinking, believing, and acting process, all of those processes, until that conditioning is seen, it's difficult to realize that any condition, any state, any experience, any space, any feeling, any moment is by nature transitory. What would be the point of trying to cultivate things that are transitory? And the answer is very clear: to make it better. To make the transitory better. Thing is, no one ever arrives at the completion of this. This isn't to say it's a senseless, ridiculous endeavor. Let's just be clear about the context. It's fine to move the furniture around in the room. Just recognize you're not changing the room. As transitoriness, which is in a way a big part of what we're practicing to see, as transitoriness shines through more and more, the grasping, the holding, owning tendency in the mind softens, and that's all it ever is a tendency. If you like, you could call it a habit. Apparently slowly, but actually it all happens suddenly. Everything happens suddenly. Everything is instantaneous. It comes clear that there's nothing better or worse than anything else. The tendency in the mind to divide things, Steve mentioned the subtle division sometimes between practice and, he used the word, normal life. This is a very popular thing that comes out of progressive path teachings, is people have notions of practice meditation, and I'm doing my meditation, I'm on retreat, and then there's my life, my normal life, as if this isn't normal. But what do we call this, abnormal? Some people would call this abnormal if they walked in here this afternoon and saw 20 of us standing there with our hands on our heads like this and heard us moaning as we breathed out. Breathe deep into your belly. Breathe deep into your belly now. Ah! I thought this was a religious spiritual retreat center. What the hell is going on in that room? There have been more than a few people over the years that watch these slow ants walking. And they go, that looks like a mental hospital. And you know what? They might not be wrong. Oh, but what about the teaching, pith instruction? Judge not lest ye be judged. Let's figure that one out. I can't help it, I say. I can't help but judge. I haven't accepted myself yet, so I project my unacceptance of myself onto other people and I judge them. I can't help it. Judge not lest ye be judged. I don't understand. I'm going back to my breath. Pith instructions are very subtle. The tendency in the mind to divide the higher, the lower, the better, the worse. Little tiny bit of division, big giant division. Spread it any way you want. Go on a diagonal. Better, worse. Same level, but just one's a little higher. Just any way that it comes out. This dividing of higher, lower, better, worse can fall away. And in it falling away, a taste of indivisibility shines through. This is a taste of non-dual truth. What pith instructions point at, not all cases, but some cases, is non-dual truth, immediacy. Oneness, wholeness, completeness, bang, here, now. They even go further and say, you already are that. What you're looking for is what you already are. But then people hear this and they go, I can't disagree, but I don't know what that means. Doesn't make sense. I haven't found that yet. I don't think this is what I'm looking for. At least the way it feels today. Or maybe it was this afternoon. I don't know when your moment is. It's like, this ain't it. And yet, this non-dual indivisibility, as and when it arises, little bit, lot, all the way, as it shines through, it makes complete, direct sense. And when we think about this, it'll make sense in our thinking, too. And why is that? It's that because of the direct realization that predates the thinking. When you think about something that makes sense to you, when you think about that thing, what predates that thinking is the direct realization, often very subtle, that allows the thinking to conceptualize in a way, you know, that makes sense, feels true. Consider this for a moment. This is always the case with things that make sense. Our thinking is only thinking about what has already made sense in our direct experience. Don't take my word for it. Check it out. Sometimes in life, it can feel as if things are piling up. They're building up. They're getting stored. They're getting stashed. It can feel as if one is starting to carry a backpack and one did not intentionally put it on. And it's getting heavier. It's getting loaded. One can think about why this seems to be so, trace it back. I might be holding this. I think there's some anger, some hurt, and this and this. I was working too hard, blah, 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 blah. And then employ numerous methods or techniques for lightening the load. And there's a whole plethora of techniques for lightening the load, isn't there? From stretching to breathing to diet, cleansing, massage, acupuncture, homeopathy, meditation, Tai Chi, yoga, different kinds of breathing, different kinds of yoga, different kinds of Tai Chi, Qi Kung. Just open your hand. Turn it over. Let go. So many methods. So many. Can't count them up. Here's how you lighten your load. I love getting the Omega Institute catalog. Summer camp for the adults. The latest way to word how to unburden your relationship. How to open your heart chakra within your heart chakra. You haven't experienced the glow of your heart chakra. It's amazing. You just look at the... And it's in a way, it's beautiful because people go to what they need. I went to that place once as a volunteer, and I spent most of my time sleeping in my tent. This is confidential. I did show up for my job. The rest of the time I slept. There was a lot going on. The backpack was heavy, and I was trying to sleep it off. And I want to tell you, it was somewhat successful. However, I missed a lot of what goes on there because I was sleeping and then I was doing my job. I've had to get the catalog over the years to see what's really going on. And I still don't know what's really going on. But the catalog points at it. It's got pictures and words and smiling faces. Sometimes the faces aren't smiling. They're looking contemplative. They're not even looking at the camera exactly. Judge not, lest she be judged. What was not said to me along with that teaching was playfully speak the truth without condemning. I had to figure that one out. So this notion of the unloading methods and techniques for the letting go. Embedded in that is a view of a kind of living that is so common, it's so often taken for granted, as the way life is or has to be. It builds up, let it go. It builds up, let it go. Inside this, watch this now, inside this, there's another view, because view exists within view and view and view and view. It's not just one view, multiplicity of views, layers of view. Everyone here is hearing this talk through view, or perhaps not. Because right view, yeah, actually is the end of view. That's a pith instruction. The end of view, no view. That's right view. Any more words about that? It's like, what can be said? Right view is no view? Can't easily even think about that anymore. Can't come up with an example. Can't find a simile, metaphor, analogy very easily. Unless the recognition of right view begins to arise, then other words appear out of that spacious emptiness. Inside the view of the building up and the letting go, building up and letting go, is the view that life is about accumulating things. And they're good things, hopefully. They're desirable things. They're nice things. They're my things. And with that, right there, right beside it, is the hope, you might say, wish, action, intention even, to not have the bad things come. To not have the bad things accumulate. To not have the undesirable occur. And if you listen to the progressive Buddha Dharma teachings, you hear things like cultivate the wholesome, relinquish, abandon the unwholesome, and the list of wholesomes given, and the list of unwholesomes given, and you know you got mostly the unwholesome. And you wish it wasn't true, but the list says it, and you don't have tranquility, and you don't have concentration, and you don't have bliss, and you don't have joy, and you barely have interest. Even when Steve said, take interest, and you looked and there wasn't any. But when you looked, you saw there wasn't any, and you were interested that there wasn't any. And you're a little hopeful. And I got to get in the other guy. I've got to get into the wholesome. There must be more wholesome in here. Where will it come from? I'll eat better. I'll read. Imagine what it was like for Rumi. And the Shams of Tabriz, and this is apparently true, the Shams of Tabriz took Rumi's books, and these books were precious in the 12th century. These books are books of truth. The Shams of Tabriz, soon to be, not yet recognized, as the friend, capital F, the friend. That's the beloved. That's the ongoing, constant, uninterruptible pith instruction flowing right through a human being. He takes the books of Rumi and he throws them in the water. Basically destroys them. These are viewed as precious, beyond precious. He says, boom, you don't need them. And in case you don't know the story, I'll skip a few pieces and go to the emergence of the poetry, the stories, the jokes, the drunkenness. The divine drunkenness in the poetry did not emerge until the Shams of Tabriz had been killed by some people who couldn't stand the love, openness flowing through his being. They kidnapped him and they killed him. And when Rumi learned of this, he's in Damascus, he's wandering in Damascus or walking, but when he learns that the Shams of Tabriz has been murdered, it shatters his heart. And he realizes in the shattering of his heart that the Shams of Tabriz has always been within him as his true being, and the poetry starts. Sounds kind of preachy, Paul. Am My 93-year-old dad, I'm sure, is sleeping at this moment. Every now and then he had a pith instruction himself. I'll give you his main one, which he gave me over and over, repeatedly. He said numerous times, without additional words following, God is love. He believes Jesus is better than the Buddha, though. He sleeps more than he's awake. I think he's waiting to leave. More often than not, his mind is lucid and he says things like this in the middle of a sequential, it appears to me, conversation. Do you remember the sound of the horse's tail swishing as it hits the back of the horse, son? I'm not going to say, Dad, is that a pith instruction? I say, yes, I do, vaguely. Tell me more. And then the mind wanders again because the brain is falling apart. Ours is too. His is just a little bit further along than most of ours. It's falling apart. Not careful, we end up living life with this subtle or not so subtle notion of collecting the desirable and avoiding and being unfettered by the undesirable. Little do we know that as we're collecting the desirable, there's fetteredness within it. However, it makes sense from the perspective of not wanting to suffer or wanting to be happy and content that I have as much of the desirable and as little as the undesirable as possible. Makes sense in my mind because when the undesirable comes, I'm vulnerable to its effect. It makes sense from both the perspective of wanting to not suffer and from wanting to be happy and content. However, it doesn't make complete sense, and here's why. Number one, prioritizing or wanting desirableness does not insure against undesirable happenings. Having columns for how experiences are charted, good and bad, divides and separates life, and living in division is unsatisfactory. And the most subtle. Contentment and happiness are not found through getting what you want. Little bit of it is, but it's actually quite surface. Hidden inside getting what you want, what we don't realize when you want something, and your mind going for it, going for it, going for it, and then you get it and you feel cessation, what's ceasing? The delusion is, I'm happy now, I'm contented now because I got what I wanted. The truth is, you're happy now, contented now because desire fell away. That's why all human beings, even the ones that are going after things more and more, their whole life is about getting better, better, better. I met a few people like that. The greediest man I think I ever met. Chain smoked. When he finished smoking the cigarette, he'd flick it right beside you. It was frightening to be near him the way he talked, moved, looked, smoked, and threw his cigarettes. Full of alcohol, full of money, full of greed. Buy anything I want. They won't sell me that land, I'll give them twice as much. They won't sell it for twice as much, I'll give them three times as much. This mind felt like it was in hell, spending a few minutes interacting with him. Contentment and happiness are not found. The deeper contentment and happiness are not found through getting what I want. Even if I have all my ideas worked out about what that is, including my spiritualized ideas, my so-called ideas about enlightenment or liberation. Let's remember, those are just ideas. We can go on a long time, a good long while, in this sort of mentality and not question or consider that this is just a view of how to live. And that as much as we try to maintain or even cultivate the desirable, we're always going to be vulnerable to the arising of the opposite. And what makes something desirable or undesirable, watch this, what makes something desirable or undesirable is so often how it feels. And that feeling is conditioned by how it's perceived. So there's the view again. What goes unexamined until it is examined is the connection between the desirable and non-desirable pendulum swing and the weighted backpack. What makes the backpack heavy is the view that life is this pendulum swing between desirable and undesirableness. It's not so much the desirable and the undesirable perceptions and feelings, it's the view that life is this way. This is the way life is. And that it's going to keep swinging between desirable and the undesirable. And I am swinging with it. If life is in fact set up this way, then I probably should and will go on trying to cultivate the desirable and try to not have the undesirable. I should probably do that, don't you think? If that's how life really is set up, if that's the way it really is, then I should probably pursue that. If that's the truth of the way things are, that life has to swing between desirable and undesirableness, then the best I could do would certainly be better than Sigmund Freud when he said the best a human can do is just typical ordinary sadness. Dear Siggy, if you're listening, were you on cocaine the night you said that? Or was it a lucid moment of your own pathos? Sadness is the best you can do? I think I can do better than that by cultivating the desirable. And trying to avoid the undesirable. If you're not careful, that's how the mind hears the teachings. Hears the teachings as cultivate the desirable. Avoid, eliminate. If you've got the undesirable within you, eliminate it. Release it. Let it go. Eradicate it. Go beyond it. In this view of the swinging pendulum of desirable and undesirable, the quality and the depth of happiness, joy, or awakening will be based on what I can successfully cultivate. And of course, right beside that, flip the coin over, it must be measured by what I can successfully let go of. What I can cultivate, what I can let go of. What I can cultivate, what I can let go of. And isn't it interesting to see that some of us are more successful in cultivating things, regardless of how much we have to let go of? See, because some people will tell you that you have something that you need to let go of that you yourself don't see. They'll tell you things about yourself that you didn't even ask them to tell you. And the scary thing is, sometimes they're right. You have anger in you. You're holding on. And you don't have to go to a therapist who crosses that boundary and decides to tell you what you need. You just hang out with people long enough. And they may, with love, with contempt, with conceit, with anger themselves, with clarity themselves, say, you need to let go of that. Or they'll say, you need to cultivate that. You need more of this in your life. The least effective way to help another human being is to give them advice, because it goes against an aspect of human nature which is very simple and is rooted right down in the childhood. And most of us don't remember this, but if somebody put a diaper on you and you didn't like it, and you might remember this, you may have worked to figure out how to get it off. And if it was before the days of the Velcro, it was more difficult because it's pinned. If you've ever seen a little one with the diaper on there, with the pin still there, and they're working on getting that pin, they figured out that this thing could come off, because it came on and I'd like it off. But as we became more modern, we don't have to bother with pins. You just go. And whether there's a mud pie in there or not, I'm free now. My butt's free. I'm out. You don't want to pee in the toilet, the little plastic thingy. You want to pee where you want to pee. You want to be like our Aboriginal. Right out there. Bang. Human nature says, I want to do what I want to do, not what you want me to do. It takes a lot of trust. A lot of trust. Maybe even faith. Two different things. Don't have time to go into it. Where somebody seems right enough for you to put yourself there, your heart, your body, your mind, and do what they tell you to do. Whether you know it or not, we collectively, the race of us, not all of the race of us, but portions of the race of us humans, are going into the post-guru era. Because the pitfalls and difficulties of the belief that somebody has it and somebody doesn't, and somebody's going to transmit it to the person who doesn't have it, is fading, and what's emerging instead is a little bit more like the Shams of Tabriz and Rumi's relationship. It's called friendship. It's called we're all in it together. It's called we're all teachers and students simultaneously. We're all giving and receiving simultaneously. It's a pith, instantaneous instruction. And if you want to see this, it's happening all over the globe in different quarters and spaces, coming through a lot of young people, chronologically young. It's not just post-religion, it's organized religion, it's post-guru. In this view of cultivation and elimination, life appears to be about experiences, states, even though there might be some insight into the fact that these states are transitory and ephemeral, they don't last. Still, these states, these experiences, these feelings, these thoughts, these desirable things, these undesirable things, can make up a lot of the bread and butter of the life, a lot of the commerce. So much so, at times, they seem like the very substance of life. So I ask you now, is this how life really is? Or is this just how I think or believe it is? Is this how life really is? Or is this just how life can at times be viewed? no doubt that experiences are part of the substance of life. Is this the totality? Is the totality of life experiences, states, thoughts, feelings, sensations, the stuff that's been looked at here in meditation, which is the same stuff that's going on in the so-called non-meditation of your normal life? If there's any observation or meditative awareness going on, you don't need to be sitting at the Franciscan Center to have meditative awareness. You're driving a car with meditative awareness. Touching the stick shift with meditative awareness, because there's the direct sensation. Don't close your eyes. Except for a second. Now watch this. At times, the unsatisfactoriness of cultivating experiences or attempting to eliminate things that have been accumulated becomes glaringly unsatisfactory. Glaringly, inherently insecure and unhappy. Because the view itself is distorted. The influence of this view conditions subtle, and I mean subtle at times, pervasive unhappiness, unfulfillment and instability in humans. When there's a relatively fixed notion of an I, me, or self that's cultivating states and qualities, that I, me, or self progressing through time, hopefully if it all works out to a better place, at some point in the future, which has not come yet, then it's a very short step. Very short, I might say, just a turn of the foot into a process, and it's always a process, of letting go of what conditions unhappiness and unfulfillment. They go together, so close together, they're not even two sides of the same coin. Cultivating, attempting to let go. And what's the purpose of this? We have no idea what we're actually trying to get, except perhaps the elimination of what aggravates. The absence of what aggravates. That's what I want. And the absence of what aggravates, even when it appears, we hope this approximates fulfillment. Is this it? Is this it? Ah. Little do we see at times that's being measured. It's being calculated. It's actually being compared and judged. The question is, does life have to go on with this kind of setup? If you're beginning to sense how it doesn't work, then you're where I am in this talk. When we come to face the fact that it's absolutely futile, to be striving for fulfillment through the cultivation of experiences and the elimination of the undesirables, if we realize the absolute futility of this, one of three things will arise most commonly, and they often come in order, sometimes rapid fire. The first is disturbance. This is not working. The second is confusion, sometimes not as disturbing as disturbance itself, but still disturbing. And as the realization dawns that this is futile to be cultivating and trying to eliminate and taking my diaper off over and over, it's comical. There's the turn. It's comical. This is totally futile. Right. A duh. It makes complete sense. Maybe I realized this before and I forgot it. But I'm glad to be remembering it now. It just took 50 years. We come face to face, totally face, in my face. We actually have no idea what realization and fulfillment is. We have no idea what we're looking for. All that can be seen there is figments of imagination born from a storehouse of memories, hopes, dreams, and projections, and more dreams. We have no idea what we're looking for. Does this mean that realization and fulfillment do not actually exist? If that's the case, what's all the hoopla about? What are we doing here? What about the traditions? What about all the time? What about all that? If they don't exist. And there's an answer to this question. The answer is they do exist. But not for the one who's looking for them. Not for the one who's looking for them through the ideas, projections, and concepts of what realization and fulfillment is. Not for that one, and not in those ideas, imaginations, fantasies, and projections. So, if they do exist, then where are they? And how are they found? Want to go there? No? If they are not, shall we just say, if it, why don't we just take realization, fulfillment, and go? Same thing. Simpler language. If it is not in states and experiences that come and go, then where is it? What is it, where is it, and how does it arise? What, where, how? Absolutely critical to realize there's nothing wrong with experiences. If you, whatever you think yourself to be, believe or assume or view realization and fulfillment's going to arise when experiences are eliminated out of the way, You're going to become pretty, pretty lonely. Just to name one state that could come. Pretty isolated. You might be renounced. But if you're not careful, you're going to be horny. And there's nothing worse than a horny celibate. Renunciate. The old Buddhist monk was asked by the pith question. Good pithy question. You can have a pithy question as well as a pithy statement. The student asked the old monk, "What do you think about when you lose contact with your breath?" Without hesitation, he said, "Sex." Sex is what I think about. Worked for the group. Not sure it's working for you. It's critical to realize there's nothing wrong with experience. It's part of what happens here. You don't have to get rid of experience, and you don't have to make more of it than it is. Shoot right down the middle. Don't have to get rid of it. Don't have to make more of it than it is. However, as the clear seeing of the nature of experiences emerges, appears brighter and brighter and brighter, that it's all by nature transitory, arising and passing, then not only is there a spontaneous cessation of clinging and grasping, but even more important, the view that there's something to let go of falls away. The view that there's something to let go of falls away. It comes clear that there never was anything to let go of, and there never will be. But instead, the very nature of experience is that it transforms naturally and spontaneously by itself. You could say it lets go of itself. This is often a huge relief. It's a relief that's so big the backpack can lose quite a few pounds or totally empty. Fall off the back. And let's be clear, as this view falls away, it doesn't matter what sensations are in this part of the body. As the view that there's something to let go of falls away, then right with it goes the view that there's something to cultivate. The view that there's something to let go of falls away automatically, spontaneously, the view that there's something to cultivate falls away. And it becomes clear. There's nothing to get rid of, and there's nothing to gain. And as this shines forth, what then appears, or you could say remains, better word, remains, is fulfillment or realization and openness. An openness that everything appears in. And in fact, everything that's appearing is this openness. Everything that's appearing is this openness itself. What we've been looking for is the openness of life itself. Now, it appears free from seeking, and this is what realization is. The fullness of life, free from seeking. What is happening the stability of the allowance of this that's happening. And that allowance of what is happening, there's not someone who's doing this allowance. The idea that there's someone here who's accepting, letting go, cultivating, that's being allowed by something. That stability, that total stability of allowance, within which everything happens. These are inseparable. That which is happening and the allowance of it is inseparable. How? One sentence. It's all we need. How it's happening is a wondrous miracle. It's a mysterious, unfathomable mystery. And that's what we are. We are that wondrous mystery. That miracle. In conclusion, the Indian monk Padmasambhava eighth century, brings Buddha Dharma from India to Tibet. The teachings are immeasurably deep and contain all wisdom. Although they are to be contemplated in a variety of ways, there are no two things such as contemplation and contemplator. When fully complemented, these teachings merge with the seeker. Although when sought, the seeker, him herself, cannot be found. Thereupon, the goal of the seeking is attained. The seeker never existed. The idea that you're a seeker is an idea that is seeking the end of itself. Upon the goal of seeking attained, the end of the search. At this point, there's nothing more to be sought and no need to seek anything. Since there are no two such things as practice and practitioner, if by those who practice or do not practice, the practitioner of practice is sought and not found, thereupon the goal of practice is reached and also the end of practice itself. The uncreated, self-radiant wisdom of original mind, actionless, immaculate, transcendent, over acceptance and rejection, transcendent over acceptance and rejection, is itself the perfect practice.
Thank goodness. miss someone like him
brought the Dharma from India to Tibet. What the seeking is seeking is the openness of life itself, free from seeking. And this is exactly the pith instruction in the Gospel of Thomas, which I can't find. Recognize what is in your sight, and what is hidden will become clear to you. He's speaking directly to the openness, free from seeking. Recognize what is in your sight, and what is hidden, this is the liberation from seeking, that's hidden until it isn't, will be revealed to you. Now the words are funny because there's no you there that recognizes that, there's just seeing. Or if you want, you could say a different you. Doesn't matter. Can we sit for a minute?